From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artists tonight for you. All their info at coasttocoastam.com. Go up and take a look at some of their fine work. And next hour, all the makings of a classic coast-to-coast show, from Ancient Aliens to The Shift, The Grand Unified Theory, a riveting story of suppression of information, holding back. Here's what's happening. Top U.S. officials said the exact nature of the suspected al-Qaeda threat that we've been talking about for several days that has now temporarily shuttered key U.S. diplomatic posts across the Middle East and North Africa remains unclear, and that intelligence suggests that the significant event could mean either one of two things, either a large attack or simultaneous attacks across the globe. Meanwhile, officials are saying that late as of Sunday, 19 embassies and consulates would remain closed through next Saturday. And officials say that the threat appears to be linked somehow to Yemen, but State Department spokespeople have only confirmed that the warnings are generally tied to al-Qaeda. Let's check in with Doug Hagman, the private investigator who also monitors special websites. Doug, this rhetoric, I don't know how to take it. How about you?
Well, George, I think we're seeing something a little bit more ominous take place here. I think we're seeing the effect, or about to see the effect, or blowback of our actions in the Middle East and elsewhere. And I think we need to look at the broader picture of what the U.S. policy has been and continues to be in the Middle East, especially with Syria, Syria first, and then Iran, which are proxy nation states of Russia and China, respectively. This is not about some small al-Qaeda threat. They would not simultaneously close this many embassies throughout the Middle East and North Africa. This is an indication, in my view and other analysts' view, of something way more ominous. And actions are taking place all over the world right now that indicate that we're involved in at least two major new fronts of political conflict that could escalate into military conflict through proxies, those being Russia and China via Iran, Syria, and North Korea.
Doug, I must have gotten, though, today about 50 emails from people are saying, here we go, a false flag, keep your eye on it. I don't know how to take that. How about you?
No, I don't think that this is a false flag at all. I think this is something much bigger and directly tied to U.S. supplying arms to the Syrian rebels, to Assad, and the other part of the chessboard, Iran. And we've been engaged in a Cold War now that has the potential to turn into a hot war very quickly. So what we're seeing, according to my sources, at least in this venue, is extremely serious, which is representing the fact that these embassies will remain closed. It's unprecedented for this extended period. So it shows the gravity of the threat, the asymmetrical warfare on a three-dimensional chessboard, and is intended to damage our ability to function in that area.
All right, Doug, we shall see what happens during this week. We'll all keep our eyes on this thing. Well, it's a sign of the times. After purchasing the Boston Globe back in 1993 for then record $1.1 billion, the financially troubled New York Times has just announced that it has sold the 141-year-old newspaper to the Boston Red Sox owner John Henry for just $70 million. Now, just $70 million to us, that's a lot of money, right? But when you think of the New York Times paying $1.1 billion for it, it's a steal. Taking a loss at 93%, it's a sign of the times. The internet is crushing the newspaper business. I've got some dear friends who are in the newspaper business or at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, great writers, superb investigators, and everybody's worried there about their own futures and about their own jobs. The internet is literally clobbering the newspaper business. Well, he struck an imposing figure as Khan, the villainous Klingon commander who struck fears in the hearts of the Federation, and the man who played him in three Star Trek's, Michael Ancera, has died at the age of 91. I always liked him as an actor. He used to be married to Barbara Eden of I Dream of Jeannie fame, and he was born in Syria, came over to the United States, and built his way up. He'd been an actor for years. Michael Ancera dead at the age of 91. Okay, that's the voice of Stephanie Quayle. She's the daughter of our guest, Stephen Quayle, and I am predicting that she may very well be one of the top country singers in the not-too-distant future. And with us featuring emerging artists for the first couple hours tonight, let's bring Stephanie in. Stephanie, you're still doing a great job, and you moved from Montana to Nashville, I hear.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing great. So tell me about this career move for you.
It was the best decision I ever made, George. It was really something it was the fall of November. We're looking like November of 2011. And it just was the time. My gut just said, now is the time to move to Nashville. And as soon as I got to Nashville, I just got into the songwriting scene as much as I could. I'd go to songwriting rounds where there's four or five songwriters up on stage and they each play one song in a round. And I would go meet with songwriters, and anyone who would give me a chance to write with them, I would take it. I would take any opportunity I could. And I really worked on the craft of songwriting. And that's what the last year and a half has been about. And that's what's gotten me to the point where I could record this new music.
Well, good for you. Stephanie, as you know, the music business is competitive. It is tough. It is ever-changing. Yet you've come out with a great song here, Stand Back, which is going to be released shortly to country radio. And I've got to tell you, we've admired your dad for years. And when he was telling me, and as you know, you and I have talked over the years as I watched your career develop, he said, George, you're going to love this. And it's going. Was it difficult for you to get to this point?
You know, I'm having such a great time building, learning, creating, and having to find a way that, sure, it's difficult in the sense of, you know, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, there's you have to be relentless. You have to be persistent. But I love the challenge, and I love getting to create music that I'm so passionate about that I can share with the fans and that the fans are responding to, that I'm having the time of my life.
Well, for
I love it when people tell me I can't, you know.
That's right. Tell you can't, then you do it. Well, you're in the
exactly.
Great spot for that. I mean, Nashville, that's the hit of country music. That's where it's at. And, you know, I love Montana, and it's a great place to be. But if you're going to be in the music business for what you do, you have to be there. You're calling your label Rebel Engine. How did that happen?
Yes. So a couple years ago, I was thinking about, you know, when I put out this project that I'm putting out right now, I wanted to come up with a name for my company that would really embody everything that we are, you know, everything that, you know, this do-it-yourself kind of business that I'm in. You know, you see a lot of artists now doing this kind of an independent way. And so when I was thinking about it, I was reflecting back on the childhood book, you know, The Little Engine That Could. And I started thinking about that. I'm like, yeah, okay, that works. And then Rebel Engine, you know, someone who kind of goes against the grain, doesn't follow the rules per se, and, you know, it doesn't take a no for an answer. So it was really, it's kind of take on its own life, too, Rebel Engine. My fans are calling themselves Little Rebel Engines, and I just love what it symbolizes, and it's really exciting.
All right, well, good luck to you, Stephanie. And Stephanie's website, of course, linked up under our Emerging Artists section at coasttocoastam.com. A little bit later on, you're going to hear another one of her songs during our Emerging Artists. Good luck to you, Stephanie. I think that's so exciting to see somebody build their career and go. And I'm predicting in the country music field, which I don't have a lot of experience in, Stephanie is going to do a great job, like her father does, with all the things that he brings to our program as well. Instead of hail to the chief, President Barack Obama is most likely hearing happy birthday. He turned 52 today, spending part of the day at Camp David on a little retreat and enjoying himself. Well, happy birthday, Mr. President. I'm not quite like Marilyn Monroe singing and whispering like she did for JFK, but there you go. And in a moment, Jerry Corsi's joining us. Dr. Corsi has done an investigation called What Went Wrong, his latest work about the inner workings of the political world on just what happened to the GOP. Now, this is not going to be a political interview at all with Jerry. It's going to be something that affects all of us. What happens on the inside during these presidential campaigns when so many people think, I've got this election sewn up, and they lose? Jerry Corsi's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, we're going to talk about what went wrong. Dr. Jerome Corsi with me, PhD from Harvard University, noted author, also writes for WND.com. Some of his books, Atomic Iran, Black Gold Stranglehold, The Late Great USA, and, of course, the latest, What Went Wrong. Jerry, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, George. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Hey, by the way, I am more convinced than ever that the abiotic oil theory that you and I have talked about over these years is absolutely correct.
Oh, no question about it, George. Some of the peak oil websites are even closing down.
I heard that.
Yes, I think theoildrum.com is now closed. It closed at the end of July, simply because peak oil theory did prove to be a hoax, like we had been talking about, you know, almost for 8 years now. And with the fracking techniques, with the realization that various forms of synthetic oil or alternative procedures to derive oil, and coal, by the way, worldwide, again, the abundance of oil and coal is remarkable. And I think it's just impossible to maintain that this oil and coal came from, you know, decaying biological debris. When the Earth itself is capable of producing oil, we can make synthetic oil. The Nazis were making synthetic oil in World War II, as I pointed out when I wrote The Great Oil Conspiracy. So, you know, the idea that the fossil fuel theory, which I think was always a just bogus science, I think is now under greater challenge than it's ever been.
I think so too, Jerry. And you know, we'll do more on that in the not too distant future.
I look forward to that, George.
Jerry, what went wrong? You know, every 4 years, Americans go to the polls and they elect a president that they hope is going to change their destiny. And every 4 years, they whine about the president that they've elected, whether it's Barack Obama or George Bush or Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter or you name it. I think probably the only one that didn't get the widespread whining was Ronald Reagan when he was in office. Why do people seem to be so changeable every 4 years?
Well, I think, George, what's going on is we're a very fundamental change is happening in presidential politics. And what I learned in the 2012 election is that the Barack Obama campaign has got to be regarded as a game changer. This is a remarkable campaign, the second remarkable campaign that Barack Obama has run. And whether people like Barack Obama or not is not the question. I mean, I'm a professional political scientist. I think we've got to appreciate just how, you know, creative and brilliant this campaign was. I rode for 3 weeks as traveling press on George Romney's airplane. Every stop, every city, every speech, for the last 3 weeks, and it's grueling experience for the traveling press. And when the last flight going back to Boston on election day, Romney came to the back of the press with the traveling press, and he said he was absolutely confident he was going to win. And in fact, he said he had not written a concession speech. And I was, you know, pretty stunned at that. And then I asked us, Stuart Stevens, who is one of the probably the top campaign strategists for the Romney campaign, and Stuart agreed that they were going to win and said, well, the vote for Obama in Ohio had not been strong enough, and that Stevens really believed that a good message trumped a ground game every time. That's what Stuart told me. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not so sure that's correct. And of course, we got to Boston, and within 2 hours, the election was over, and Obama had won decisively, won 6 of the 7 swing states. And so I started saying, you know, what went wrong with the Romney campaign so dramatically missed what was happening?
It was huge.
They were blindsided. They didn't even realize. And I came to the conclusion it was kind of what Obama did was kind of like Moneyball in baseball. You know, if you don't understand Moneyball, you don't see how the game of baseball has transformed. You can't watch a Boston Red Sox team and really appreciate, or the Oakland Athletics, where it really began, Moneyball.
That's right.
And it was a sense of, you know, like that Obama had invented a sense of Obama metrics that redefined presidential politics and how campaigns are run, just like there's saber metrics in Moneyball.
Well, if the election were held today, would he win again against Mitt Romney?
Yes, I think so. I think Romney, as a centrist campaign, you know, Republican centrist politicians, now this is one of the major themes of my book, as I look back even to Thomas Dewey, you know, in the 1940s and certainly through the 60s against, you know, basically what they used to call the Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party, which was very centrist, very establishment. Candidates who tend to come from that, and you know, Karl Rove type of thinking, are very, very much at a disadvantage against a candidate like Barack Obama. And what the Obama people added was a unique way of looking at the campaign and a unique application of 21st century technology to essentially defeat Romney with a set of techniques that had never been used before in presidential politics. And any future presidential candidate who does not understand what Obama did, I think, will be at a decisive disadvantage to win.
Well, was it President Obama who did this, Jerry, or did he have the right campaign folks with him?
Well, I think we have to, first of all, credit President Obama with picking the right people and certainly having the intuition, kind of a new age intuition of how politics in the 21st century is going to be played. Clearly, the team, I mean, Jim Messina, the whole group that was picked, Axelrod, these are people who must be taken very seriously. They've done an historic thing. They reinvented by using computers. Let's just start with the computers, George.
Perfect.
Because
yeah.
The perception, it was not just computers. It's like what's being done by the NSA, the National Security Agency, right now. On a continuing basis, but the Obama campaign resolved to build from the grassroots up a whole new voter profile approach in which they would be able to, starting with, you know, geniuses, really, typical geeks, you know, maybe guys who wouldn't want to take to a social party, but, you know, you could put them into a back room, and they did the cave is what they called it, and the headquarters, Obama's headquarters in Chicago, and they gave these people computers and, you know, keyboards, and, you know, these people may not even be able to articulate what they were doing, but within minutes they could access the internet with hacker-like skills and begin mining any postings on the internet, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all the different social networking sites, and beginning to mine who on these sites was prospective Obama voters, with a special emphasis on the key states and the key voter segments that Obama was going to need to win. And that was a very powerful tool. It's not just computers. It's the top advice of political scientists and universities, demographers. I mean, the Obama campaign even hired a nuclear particle physicist, because of the understanding of Brownian motion and trying to map those mathematics onto people and how they behaved in politics. So this was a very, very brilliant modeling. And with combining databases that were available publicly, like credit card data or travel data or various big data banks, and integrating these together with massive computer power, the Obama campaign came out with micro-targeting. They could basically profile, George, you or me, and people like us.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the power. I mean, this is a thinking about how you can take 300 million people and very systematically start to sort people into groups on the question, who's going to vote and who are they going to vote for?
Now, in the 2016 election, and that's going to be interesting to see that unfold.
Yeah.
Will anybody look at how Barack Obama's campaign handled things, and will they change and alter their own planning?
It's mandatory. You have to. There's no future political candidate running for president. In fact, down to the state and local level, any candidate running for office today has got to understand what the Barack Obama campaign did. And you can't start out with a like or dislike of Barack Obama. You've got to just acknowledge, you've got to tip your hat, you know, just like with Moneyball. It's not a good or bad or like or not like. Moneyball changed baseball because of the perception that it wasn't batting average. It was the ability to get on base, even if you get hit by the ball.
Yep.
And here, what Obama was showing people was that once you learn how to cut through the electorate and get down to, you know, an analysis of what you've got to do to win, which votes do you need, where, what profile, which voter segment, what, and how to find them through the computer individually, which can be done, sorting through, and then get it to the field.
Hold on, Jerry. We're going to come back and talk more about what went wrong. Why are we not hearing the real story of extraterrestrial presence and other things that have been going on this planet? Next hour, Daniel Davis checks in with us as we talk about From Ancient Aliens to the Shift, the Grand Unified Theory. Very riveting piece of work by Daniel Davis. When we come back in a moment, Dr. Jerry Corsi, What Went Wrong? And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Jerome Corsi. And of course, in 2012, the Obama administration, Jerry, raised a fortune over the internet. They understood that. Did the Romney campaign not even use the internet?
The Romney campaign used the internet, but it's like a whole different phenomenon. It's not just that they were more computers or better computer scientists for the Obama campaign. It was a whole different phenomenon, a whole different level. In other words, the Romney campaign, on the day of election, their whole get-out-the-vote computer system crashed. It had never been beta tested. They never thought to turn it on nationwide and see if it would burn out the servers. Whereas the Obama people had been, crisis testing for months the get-out-the-vote system and had all kinds of backups and alternatives, really a computer science approach to, catastrophic shutdown of their servers. And so the Obama campaign was prepared for the massive volume they were going to have on election day. And it's a fundamental different way of thinking, because any, modern computer scientist working on the internet is going to know that kind of a fail-safe that the Obama campaign did is absolutely necessary.
Well, and what's happening too, Jerry, is this whole country is changing in terms of demographics.
No question, George.
And so if you're shrewd enough to pick up the ethnic vote, and if you can pick up a heavy percent of the woman vote,
yes,
and then just get your fair share of the male vote, you're going to win the election.
Well, in fact, the demographics and the slicing of demographics, the realization of the trends that more Hispanics in the United States, increasing percentage of the voters, more single women, often single women with children, the more of secularization of the United States, so the more divorce, young people who are not graduating with college with a certain future, but are, percentage taking jobs, if they can get them, that are substandard given their education. All these demographic trends have to be modeled onto what Obama did with interest group politics to say, all right, am I going to target single women with children? And what's my message to the single women? How do I communicate that? And then the ability through the computer system to not only measure that message to that group, but also to try alternatives, almost experimentally with messages, and see how it affects that group, single women, and to form equations predicting how this particular voter group is going to vote. Now, that's a whole new science, way beyond polling. What the Obama people did was they invented a whole new technology where polling is obsolete. And, the metrics that were being used by the Romney campaign, was measuring big crowds, which is typical good measure.
Right, that's old-style polling.
Old-style. They were measuring, our polls look good, especially after the first debate. And the Obama people were saying, instead of a poll, Obama had real data on real voters and modeled those voters in Ohio and Florida and the other swing states. And they were running tens of thousands of simulations every day, maybe 20,000 computer simulations of the voters' profile, the mathematics of the voters in Ohio, to say, do we need 50,000 more votes in Cuyahoga County? And which message is going to affect the demographics of Ohio in order to produce that result?
And they went right for it.
Right for it. Yeah. Right for it. Focused on it.
What did Ron Paul do wrong, Jerry, in that the guy won with internet polling every debate? Every debate in the Republican end, he won. He won handily. But what happened? He just didn't get that acceptance by the party.
Well, I think Ron Paul is an emerging politician, so I don't, I think he's a little different today than he was, his father was. Rand Paul in the Senate is not Ron Paul, who we're talking about in terms of the campaign of 2012.
Right. And Rand, Rand Paul may run in 2016.
And Rand Paul is going to understand the Obama metrics that I'm talking about in what went wrong. Rand Paul will read the book. Rand Paul is a very close follower of WND, and he is attuned to, you know, the New Age politics. His father was a brilliant man, obstetrician, and had a brilliant career. But okay.
And people liked him.
And people, but he's gotten framed, see, by the Democrats and by the press. Framing is a psychological technique I discussed.
Well, and also, didn't his own party frame him?
And his own party framed him. And he was framed as kind of this quirky, you know, guy who has this weird foreign policy, and he's libertarian. I mean, it was almost like every time you saw Rand Paul, he began to look quirky.
Of all the public figures during the 2012, he was the only one who would come on my show. And he came on a couple times.
Well, I know Rand Paul. I've interviewed him many times. And I want to point out that the framing doesn't always represent who the person is. It represents what the other side has been able to make the person look like. So when you see them, it was done to Romney very brilliantly, framing Romney as, you know, white, rich guy, Bain Capital, fire people, throw them off their health insurance, make money. So every time you saw Romney, the framing, you saw the neatly combed hair, the button-down shirts, the pleated pants, the preppy look. Well, that was framing. That was a psychological technique employed so that when you looked at Romney, your immediate impression was that image, and it was negative.
Huh. Interesting.
And the Romney people did not understand this was being done to them. They didn't understand the psychological technique, and they didn't know how to combat it.
Well, who wins elections these days, Jerry? Is it the middle class, which has been eroding away? Who wins elections?
Well, it's a combination of various interest groups. I mean, putting them together, and each group is going to have to calculate its own interest groups. I mean, Obama started out with some massive strengths. He was going to get it over 90% of the African-American vote, 77% of the Hispanic vote, over two-thirds of the white, of the women voting. And what happened was that
and we have to say this, people yeah. were so ticked off with the Bush administration.
No question about it.
That you know, a formidable candidate like President Obama came in and, you know, being the first African-American to win at this point.
Right.
I mean, I figured one day that would happen.
Well, it's just
but not then.
People should not think I'm criticizing the strategy. This is how politics is done. You identify your interest groups, and they're different for different candidates. And you slice and dice the demographics to get down to numbers. That Barack Obama was saying, you know, I'm going to derive strength from African Americans, Hispanics, women, students, labor union members. That's just reality. That's just good politics. And Obama did it extremely well. It's not to be faulted. Each side has to do that. And the point was, though, that Obama did it with a whole new ability to understand these people, to measure them. You know, when you work for Obama as a field worker, large chances you'd be paid, so you'd be measured. You'd probably get a iPad or a smartphone. And the Obama campaign could say, go see these 50 people, and here's their addresses. Ask them these questions, see what they're, profile them, and then get 50 more. And if you don't get 50 more, you're not part of the deal. But by the time this OFA, the Organizing for America, or for Obama camp structure, the Obama for America, they've changed the name of that in its metamorphosis. But that field group of people out in the country with a mission of knowing who they had to get to vote, and what period of time they had to get them to vote, 2-3 days a week, a strategy to use that week efficiently and push it all with computers so you're monitoring it real time. That's a technology, that's a level of politics that has never been done before. And it is a massive impact that cannot be overlooked. It'll never be the same if you're not able to do that kind of effective outreach, grassroots up, community organizing thinking. You're not going to be able to reach your voters in the electorate, and the other side has the potential, as they did with Romney, to clean his clock.
And they did. Now, in What Went Wrong, you dedicate the book to old St. Louis and Phyllis Schlafly,
yeah.
the American constitutional lawyer. Tell me why.
Well, Phyllis wrote a book in the 1960s called, and Phyllis is a dear, dear friend and a great mentor. I'd say hello to her and hope she's listening.
She's going to be 88 years old in about a week or so.
Just remarkable, and her contribution.
89, maybe, I think. She's going to be 89.
I just saw her about 2 weeks ago, and she's doing very, very well. I was very pleased. I saw her. I gave a speech for her in Washington, which may be on Book TV here soon. At any rate, what Phyllis did in the 60s is she wrote a book called A Choice, Not an Echo. And her whole point in the 60s, and she was brilliant because it applied to the 40s and applies to today, was that these centrist establishment Republican candidates tend to lose because they learn the wrong lessons out of their losses. They get to the point of saying, we've got to be more like the Democrats. We've got to be more Democratic than the Democratic. And it ends up, pandering to Hispanics, or losing the message of conservatism or of a more center-right party. Phyllis was setting the stage for Ronald Reagan's emergence. She initially supported Barry Goldwater, then Ronald Reagan emerged. And her point today was that, Romney got almost 8 million, let's say, fewer white voters than voted for McCain in 2008. And that was key because Obama got 4 million or 4.5 million fewer votes himself.
Yeah, okay.
But it was key that the voters who didn't vote, the evangelicals voted, and they voted for Romney despite the Mormonism. That Mormonism was an issue in the primaries, not in the final election.
Did that hurt him at all?
No. In fact, I say in What Went Wrong, he should have, like John Kennedy, made it an issue. He would have lost some people, but he'd have gained
more. Yeah.
By saying, this is who I am, this is why I am, and being who he is, and presenting that. And so what I'm saying, though, is this Phyllis Schlafly's point, A Choice, Not an Echo, is that these candidates who are kind of like Democrat light, like Romney, are compromised to begin with, and the voters who stayed home are the core conservative voters. See, Obama knew his base, and Obama had his base enthusiastic. He knew the messages. The African-American community was out. Hispanics were motivated. Obama voters were motivated. And even though he got 4 million fewer, the voters who were going to be Obama voters, who were not dropped off, were more intensely excited in 2012 than they were in 2008. And the Romney voters, the core conservatives, while we were getting big crowds in the rural areas where the Romney campaign was stopping every day for the 3 weeks I was on the campaign plane, there were millions of white voters who were just tuning out, saying, Romneycare, Obamacare, what's the difference? And today the Republican Party is learning the wrong lesson. They're saying, we've got to run after it. We got to show Hispanics we like them. Well, you cannot out-Democrat the Democrats. They have their game. They've established their brand. And the Democrats play their brand of, leftist centrist politics. If the Republicans abandon their rightist, right-leaning centrist politics, or go too far to the right, like Barry Goldwater did, or, go too far to the center or to the left, like Romney and McCain did, then those Republicans are going to lose. And that was Phyllis Schlafly's point. The Republican Party cannot abandon its conservative base. It's got to be conservative, and it can't pick these compromised candidates like McCain and Romney, who tend to agree with the Democrats most of the time anyway.
Jerry, when I was in college at the University of Detroit, we would study in communications classes, of course, the work of Marshall McLuhan, who wrote The Medium is the Message.
Brilliant guy.
And, at that time, 1968 to 70, 72, we're all trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean? The medium is the message.
Right.
I look back now at that, and he was absolutely correct.
100%.
Yep. You get things done, whether it's the internet or television or radio, the medium is indeed now the message.
Yes. Well, and I write about this, and I point out that even politicians, Bernays, who I knew very well, who founded public relations, was also hugely effective. But see, to take McLuhan and apply him, because the Obama people understood this, the internet today is the medium, and the message is the ability to refine how you're communicating with each voter So if people subscribe and get messages from the Obama campaign, I recommend it whether you like Obama or don't, because they're so brilliant you've got to understand it. You almost feel like Obama's talking to you. You know, Michelle will say, you know, Obama's got your back. Do you have Barack's back?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, we need $5.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people say, well, $5.
You can afford $5.
Well, and the Obama campaign realized if you gave $5, you were going to vote for Obama. If you gave $5, you could give $10. And they got it down to a little app that went on your cell phone, and you could hit that app, and it would give another $5 to the Obama campaign.
Isn't that amazing?
It's just brilliant.
Yeah, it is. And Jerry, as we look then at the future,
right?
What happens one day, technically, if the Internet goes down, and it could go down one day? You know, if we get hit with an X flare, for example, as we've been talking about for years, the Internet goes down. What are people doing? I mean, because we've been so reliant on this as a tool, I think people are going to go crazy without it.
Well, it'd be like losing electricity. I mean, it would be like, you know, the television doesn't work anymore. Our lives are so fundamentally intertwined with the technology. It's, you know, like, for instance, the technologies, the computer ability to analyze things. You know, the two other, I think, really genius influences that I look at and what went wrong, you really have to look at, you know, Bill James, the sabermetrics and Moneyball and baseball, because Bill James, every year, you know, they run these analytics. They can give you a score and a statistic on a player. Well, I think it's going to get down to being able to give a statistic, you know, a quotient likely to win after you evaluate the real factors on any candidate in any election, you know, like an Obama metric. And Nate Silver, who, you know, his book, you know, A Signal, Not Noise, who understood how that predictions and how they have to be looked at to which predictions are right and which are not, and basically throwing polling out. Polling is also an old, outmoded technology, because the ability to do these econometric-like mathematical models on real data, so you really profiled Ohio, you know your voters are, you're running simulations, you're buying experimental methodologies. And, you know, again, George, you understand what my whole point in what went wrong is to say, let's not, you know, this is beyond criticizing or liking a candidate. This is Barack Obama won. He ran a brilliant campaign. What did he do? And what he did was, you know, this was applying, you know, instead of looking at an election and just seeing the old metrics of, you know, crowds and messages and voters, Obama saw how it worked internally. So he had the mathematics mapped of what people were doing when they were watching elections, just like Moneyball is the mathematics mapped of a baseball game when you're watching it.
Absolutely genius. Jerry, where do we get the book, What Went Wrong?
Now, What Went Wrong is available everywhere. It's in the bookstores. What Went Wrong is about the inside story of the 2012 election. As available, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, WorldNet Daily, where I'm a senior staff reporter, the WND Superstore has signed copies.
It's like a handbook for 2016, isn't
That's
it?
That's how I wrote it, George. It's a handbook. It's you know, it's beyond liking or disliking candidates. This is the inside story of the new metrics and the new analysis of political science. You've got to understand if you want to participate, if you want to watch presidential politics or politics at any level.
Great. Jerry, thanks for being on the program. Got to get you back to talk about abiotic oil and that theory you and I both share. Here's our next emerging artist, Kurt Hunter, the song Sunny Day from Fullerton, California.